A small but vocal number of Catholics are convinced not only that Francis is not the Pope, but that Benedict XVI is still the valid Pope. What are their arguments, and are they right? Is Joseph Ratzinger still the Pope? We're going to talk about that today on Crisis Point. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started, I encourage you to like and subscribe to the channel. Let other people know about it. Help grow the channel. I really appreciate it if you do that. It really does help bump us up in the algorithms, the magic algorithms of YouTube and other podcast platforms if you subscribe to the channel and like this episode. Also, you can follow Crisis Media on the various social media channels, Twitter, Gitter, Gab, MeWe, Facebook, all of them. Usually it's just at Crisis Mag is the best way to find us. So today our guest is Stephen O'Reilly. He is a former intelligence officer. He's a graduate of the University of Dallas and the Georgia Institute of Technology. He's had articles published in the old This Rock Catholic Answers magazine, 1 Peter 5 and LifeSite News. He is the founder of the Roma Locuta Est blog, which provides commentary on topics related to Catholic current events and apologetics. And he's also the author of an upcoming book called Valid, The Resignation of Pope Benedict XVI, which is expected to be out in August. And that's really what we're going to talk about today. So welcome to the program, Steve.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so before we get started, let's just say what the situation is, how odd it is. Currently, there are two men living in the Vatican, at the Vatican, each wearing white papal robes, each being called Your Holiness, and each maintaining the title in some form of Pope. Obviously, this is a confusing imagery at the very least. And so a lot of people are asking the question, is Francis really the Pope? And online, this is probably a lot more vocal, a lot more strong than you would get in a regular parish. Like, I don't think there's much discussion at your regular Catholic parish about whether or not Francis or Benedict is the Pope. But if you go online, Catholic Twitter or wherever, you see there's a lot of people arguing, or it seems like a lot of people, they're at least very vocal. And to be honest, that Benedict is still the Pope. And to be honest, it is a confusing situation. And I do think there are a lot of sincere and well-meaning Catholics who are honestly unsure about the status of Francis and about whether or not Benedict is still the Pope. Now, those who don't think that Francis is the Pope, they generally fall into two categories. The one is Sedevacantists, who believe that there is no valid Pope. That just means the seat is vacant, no Pope. We're not going to talk about that today. That's a whole different discussion. What we're talking about is that group of people who believe that Pope Benedict, for whatever reason, his resignation wasn't valid, didn't happen, whatever the case may be. And so he is still the Pope. That's what we're going to talk about today. So first, I just to clear it out at the beginning, the first question I want to ask is, what do we call the people or the view that the Benedict is still the Pope? Because I've seen a lot of different names, and I've seen people get upset at the various names. So let's first clarify, what should we call this theory?
Sure. Well, when I first started writing on this subject back in, 2017, on my blog, I coined the term BIP, which just stood for just Benedict is Pope, just quite literally, even though occasionally some folks have take an exception to that somehow I'm being dismissive of them. It is not. It's just a way of naming them. Other folks have used Bene Vacantist and Bene Plenist. In my book, I decided, and recently in my blog, I've opted to use Bene Papist or Bene Papism. Again, not to be pejorative, just to be descriptive. I thought the Benedict is Pope or BIP acronym, probably, you know, long live Benedict, but you know, he is up there in age, and when he passes, you know, Benedict is Pope, it will obviously no longer be an accurate name. So I just thought Benny Papism and Benny Papist would be the terms I use on my blog and book.
Yeah, I think that's good because it's not trying to be demeaning or anything like that. Like, Benny Vacantism was kind of a silly term, and I know I used that at first too because it was kind of jokingly kind of connecting to Sede Vacantis. But of course, that makes no sense, the actual term, that Benedict is vacant or something like that. So I think, though, Benny Papist is good because it's just simply the idea that Benedict is still the Pope right now. So in just a few sentences, give the overall view of the Benny Papist position, other than just the fact that he's obviously still the Pope. Like, how would you describe that position?
Well, I think we're kind of going back to the origins. I think the Benny Papists, as you mentioned, they're sincere folks. Like I think many Catholics, traditional Catholics, conservative Catholics, they've looked at the course of this papacy almost from its very beginning and all the kind of odd things that have happened. You know, we can go to 2016 Amoris Laetitia. There's, you know, Pacamama and on the Scalfari interviews and so many other things, you kind of lose track. And so there you have this situation where people wonder, how could a pope do this? How could a true pope do this? And so folks have kind of cast about looking for theories. I mean, obviously you have things like the open letter, which accused Francis of a delict of heresy. So some folks might say Francis was a true pope, but then maybe he fell, or maybe he's just a material error, or maybe he might even be a heretic and we can't do anything about it. But the Benny Papist view was is that they look back at the original documents of the resignation and some of the oddities, say, around like St. the Gallen Mafia. You know, did they somehow force Benedict out? Was there something wrong with his actual resignation statement? And then they've kind of looked at that overall situation and have determined that his resignation was invalid. So therefore, if you can say Benedict's resignation is invalid, he's still pope. And if he's still pope, obviously Francis is not, problem solved. And we can kind of forget about things like Amoris Laetitia and all that, just have to kind of wait for the rest of the church to catch up to us or to them. That's kind of like how I think it kind of originated. And we can obviously go into some of the documents and, you know, some of the specific theories that they have.
Right. And before we do that, so it sounds to me, though, I mean, and this is how it appears to me as well, is that we have a problem. And I think a lot of Catholics, good Catholics, do acknowledge the problem. And that is Francis is doing things that a pope probably shouldn't be doing, or at least is scandalous. And so, like, there's our problem. So what is the solution? And I think there's a lot of different answers that people have come up with. One is sedevacantism, that Francis isn't the pope when there is no pope. Either he wasn't never a pope, and neither was Benedict or JP II or Paul VI, you know, going all the way back, maybe Pius XII, or that he was elected validly pope and then he fell through heresy, some public heresy that they determined. So that's one idea. Another idea is kind of the view that I think a lot of people watching this and myself, I hold, is that he is a true pope, but yes, these are problematic elements. They don't invalidate his papacy, but they do show, like in the past where popes have done things that are bad, a pope that's done things that are bad. Others have just tried to gloss over it, saying, oh, it's not really that bad. You know, it's not really, you're misinterpreting him or something like that. And then of course this view of, well, actually Benedict is still pope. So the question becomes, when did the idea that the papacy, that the papal resignation of Benedict was not valid, when did that kind of originate? Was it like right after, you know, in 2013, or did it take some time before it originated, before people started really promoting it?
Well, I think the seeds are back there for the beginning. I think there were some canonists who had looked at how he had worded his resignation, and I think it raised some eyebrows. I think early on, there might have been two or three canonists who might have said something. Then of course, probably to my recollection, some of the earlier concerns were about like the St. Gallen Mafia, the illegal campaigning, and you know, and then with regard to Benedict, was there any kind of assassination attempt? I mean, there had been like a cardinal or bishop who had made some reference to that he'd be dead within a year. There was concerns that the ATMs at the Vatican had been shut off, I think, in January of 2013, that maybe this might have been something to kind of push him out. So I think those are some of the earlier theories. And I think as early as 2014, I think it was Andrea Tornielli had interviewed Benedict. And at that point, he was even saying that the theories that his resignation was invalid were absurd. So it does go back pretty far. But I think what really, to my mind, what really kind of launched Benny Papism was Gonswain's speech in 2016. And that's when he did make some kind of hair. When you read it, on the surface at least, they seem, it really raised a lot of eyebrows, talking about an expanded papal ministry and that type of stuff. And I think it was Anne Barnhart who was the first to kind of call that out. And that's when she came up with the theory of the substantial error theory, that there was a substantial error in Benedict's resignation and his declaratio. And then they find some evidence for that also in the last audience of Pope Benedict on February 27th, 2013, the day before his resignation. And that kind of became, I think, the basis for substantial error theory, which was one has become one of the two major theories since that time.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Playlist shuffled? Check. Drinks on ice? Check. Z-Biotics? Make the most of your time with friends by starting your evening with Z-Biotics, the only pre-alcohol probiotic designed to make those rough mornings after drinking alcohol a thing of the past. Z-Biotics is key for those who live for the moment. Visit ZBiotics.com to learn more.
Yeah, and so let's get actually into now, within Benny Papism, there is multiple views of what is happening, you know, what happened and why his resignation was invalid or didn't happen or whatever. And I would say that within those, there's even breakdowns. So, for example, there on the major, one major view is what, you know, the invalid resignation theory, that basically his resignation for various reasons, one or more, it was invalid. And another one is that the other major theory is that, yeah, the resignation was invalid, but it was almost done on purpose. Like, so whether or not Benedict did it meant to do it or didn't mean to do it is somewhat debated within Benny Papism. So let's first give like the invalid resignation, the idea. Now, Canon 188 says a resignation made out of grave fear that is inflicted unjustly or out of malice, substantial error or simony is invalid by the law itself. So, for example, let's just give an example. If somebody puts a gun to Pope Francis, let's just use Pope Francis, let's say he's Pope, puts a gun to his head and says, you must announce your resignation or I will pull the trigger. And then he announces his resignation. Canon law would say that's an invalid resignation because he made it out of grave fear.
That's right.
Or if another example, you know, obviously simony, if somebody said to him, Pope Francis, I'm going to give you $1 million to resign. And then he does, and he announces resignation. He gets $1 million. Another case of an invalid resignation. So nobody's accusing, by the way, Benedict or anybody of simony here, but they are saying both the it's potentially grave fear and the substantial error. So first, explain why some people would say that Pope Benedict's resignation was made out of grave fear.
Well, I think you go back to the St. Colin Mafia. We know they existed from the mid-90s, and their reason to be was to kind of oppose Cardinal Ratzinger at the time and then later to oppose his election in the 2005 conclave. So you do have a group of people who were anti-Ratzinger from the beginning. So you have that going on, and then you have... like I said, as I mentioned before, these rumors of an possible assassination, I think that kind of surfaced around 2012. You have the financial shutdown of the ATMs for a period of time, I think in early 2013. And so the suggestion was that maybe there was something that pushed them out. But when you look at all these theories, is that there's no smoking gun that you can say this event is what led him to resign. So yeah, you could say if the St. Gallen Mafia did it, you'd still need proof that it happened. And then of course, even if you found proof today, 9 years later, the question is, would that now invalidate the resignation? That'd be probably a debate for the canon lawyers and theologians to go after. But my sense would be probably would not invalidate it because say Athanasius Snyder would say is that for situations like that, it would be healed in the root that the church has accepted this man as Pope Francis for the last 9 years, for the most part. So therefore, he is the true Pope.
So it sounds like there is some smoke when it comes to the grave fear theory, in that there were definitely some funny business going on. Now, personally, I've read enough history and like papal elections in the past. There are a lot of cases in medieval times, particularly where a lot of threats, I mean, emperors and lots of stuff going on where popes resigned. I mean, popes were basically forced to resign by emperors and things like that. Yet the church recognizes those resignations as valid. So it's almost like I feel like there have been cases of popes who have resigned out of grave fear, and the church has accepted them. So this canon that states a resignation made out of grave fear is invalid by the law itself. I mean, how do we actually reconcile this with the fact that historically, I mean, it does seem like there have been cases where popes were pushed out the door, and the church now just recognizes, that all worked out, and we're fine.
That's right. Then the other thing too I'd point out with regard to Benedict's case is that if you look at things he said in his Peter Sewald interviews, which he did actually before he resigned, and then afterwards, it's clear that he recognizes that a pope cannot leave under duress, because the question was, well, did the WikiLeaks scandal, which erupted in early 2012. And he said, no, in fact, he waited. He deferred his resignation until, you know, the gentleman was, you know, arrested. And then they had a trial, and the trial ended in late October, early November of 2012. And I think his resignation was, he settled on it in December, even though there's strong indications that he told Bertone and he told Gonswain as early as like June or July of 2012 that he was going to resign. So he deferred his resignation because of WikiLeaks. So there's no indication that he submitted to fear. And even though there might have been the smoke out there, there's no indication that he understood himself to be under any kind of duress that led him to resign.
Right. And I think that, I mean, it's almost like, you know, you brought up what Bishop Schneider had mentioned about the church accepting Francis as Pope for the past 9 years. And the idea is like, that's almost kind of what happened in historically when you had popes who were kind of pushed out of the papacy, the church accepted that and they accepted the next pope. And that in a way seems to almost trump canon law. Like, I feel like when I've talked to people who are the most adamantly for the Benny Papist position, everything is very much centered around canon law. And I don't want to dismiss canon law as unimportant, but it does seem there to be something a little bit greater than canon law working here when we have cases in the past where stuff like this has happened and the church just said, okay, but we're just going to move on with this person as Pope. Am I right there? Or am I kind of dismissing canon law too much in this case?
No, I agree. I mean, I've done a lot of research on my blog looking into the conclave. I do think there are a lot of oddities, I think, involved in that. And this might not be the place to go into all that. But as you look into these oddities and you start looking at the canon law, and I'm no canon lawyer, but it's almost like, don't do these things, don't get caught, or don't get too caught too soon. Because if enough time goes by, you know, you'll be accepted. I mean, it doesn't say that, but there are, I think the canon law is not intended there to create like a legal case to knock down a papacy, you know, 9 years later. And I think to like what you're saying, to Athanasius Snyder was saying, I mean, we can't be, you know, 9 years later, you know, going through some old textbooks, you know, dusty canon law books from, you know, 300 years ago, say, oh, here's this little thing here that means it's an invalid resignation. Then we undo 9 years and everything. You just can't do that. I mean, it is move on. I mean, I do think Francis is Pope. I wouldn't be surprised if somehow there was something that said he wasn't, but I think that when you look for a solution, you want a solution that's a good theory. And Benny Papism, and we'll get more into it, Benny Papism is a bad theory, and a bad theory is never a good substitute for a good theory.
Right. Okay, so let's move on from the fear motive to the one that's probably the more substantial, and that is that his resignation was includes substantial error, and that's part of the canon 188 that says if it's made out of substantial error. And I think this, I can't think of right off the top of my head an example, but if a bishop were to resign thinking one thing and actually doing another, you know, like being mistaken about something, perhaps, I don't know, or I don't really know the example in there, but this is the big point for the Benedict Papists, is that Benedict resigned incorrectly, invalidly, because he, and specifically when it comes to understanding the office and ministry of the papacy. So why don't you break down, and this is where, you know, people start taking notes maybe, because this is, I do think this gets a little bit confusing a little bit in the weeds, but I think it's very important because this is really where the Benny Papas argument stands or falls, is this whole idea of was it insubstantial error. So why don't you break down what they're saying here?
Yeah, well first, this is the commentaries I've seen on Canon 188. They talk about substantial error. There, it seems like the intent is that the error is the true cause of one's resignation. So for example, in fact, I think Cardinal Brandmiller gave it as an example, I think in an interview with Diane Montagna, where he said that if the Pope thought that there was a Muslim army at the gates of St. Peter's or of Rome, and he submitted his resignation out of that, the false belief, that would be invalid. So that would be an example of a true cause. Say, take for example, but if you look at the substantial error theories, I guess there's two in a sense. One is that I think, I believe Anne Barnhart would say, is that he made an error that Benedict thought he could partially resign, you know, kind of create like a bifurcate the papacy that he can keep, you know, kind of be like a passive member of the synodal papacy and Francis or his successor would be the active Pope. That would be, but obviously that's an error. You really can't do that. And therefore, his intent and what he was doing in his resignation letter would invalidate his resignation. So that's, I think, kind of like would be her view. Say Dr. Mazza, I think, would share that. But, you know, I debated him on Tim Gordon's show, and I think his view seemed to go a little bit further. I think he recognized, I'm putting words in his mouth, he seemed to recognize more that the true cause part, that you had to have what was in your mind, did matter. So he would say that Benedict had, I would, at least in my view of what he would say, is that Benedict had a erroneous view of the papal munis. I guess we maybe talk about that word in a little bit. The munis, the office, the papal office, that he thought that he could retain it after the resignation in some way. But of course he couldn't. But if he had known that he could not retain the munis, he would not have resigned. So it's actually a couple more steps. So his error in thinking he could retain it would be the cause of the substantial error. So that's kind of, I think, that's kind of it in a nutshell for the substantial error.
So break down this difference between the munis and ministerium, I think it is. Yeah, right. Munis, I wrote down. So the munis and ministerium, those are two words that are often used in this debate. Why don't you explain what each one means and why it's important for this discussion?
Sure. Well, first you go to canon, to the canons that regulate, or the canon that regulates papal resignations. Canon 332.2 says if the Roman pontiff, before me at the moment, the Roman pontiff resigns the munis, well, resigns the office, but obviously in the Latin, say resigns the munis, to be for it to be valid, what is required that it be free, properly manifested, and that it says it need not be accepted by anyone. So the substantial errorists, we'll call them, would say, okay, well, he has to resign the munis, but if you look at the declaratio, and that is the document that Benedict, it was the instrument of his resignation, and he read it to a consistory of cardinals. And in that declaratio, he, even though he uses the word munis in a couple of different spots, he kind of then overlays that with ministry. And in his actual sentence where he says, I declare, what he's going to do, he says, I declare that he resigns the ministry of the Bishop of Rome. He does not say the munis of the Bishop of Rome. So he uses the Latin word ministerium. So those who would say there's a substantial error there would say, well, munis kind of has a more technical term and there's various meanings to it, but they would say it means office, means gift, means prodigy, and a few other things. Whereas ministry or ministerium to them is more like the practical exercise of the papacy. It's kind of like the function of doing it. So you have the office and you have what the office does. So in a sense that Benedict resigned what the office does erroneously, but he still has the munis. He still has the charge of St. Peter would be the argument that they have.
So now why is that wrong? Why is it that him using the word ministerium doesn't invalidate the papacy, his resignation? And why are the Benny Papists wrong about that distinction?
Well, not all Benny Papists would necessarily agree with that, but from their standpoint, that there is no formula for papal definitions, even though, of course, the canon says the munus, but you kind of would read that just kind of generally speaking, if one was to resign the papacy, you do X, Y, and Z. There's no declaration of what word or words could be used. Ministerium in the Latin, Father Rickert, John Rickert of FSSP wrote a series of articles also on a petty papist. He points out that in the Latin, I think there's Lewis and Short's Latin dictionary, that ministerium is specifically stated to be a synonym of munus. And in other books, other Latin dictionaries, you'll find that too. The Dictionary of Ecclesiastical Latin has that the two definitions kind of overlap. You'll find office in the definition of ministerium. So there is a synonym aspect there. And so, you know, and there's no requirement for a certain formula. So I think in this case, it just the petty papist argument just doesn't work. And furthermore, even if you were to say that he intended to resign only the ministry, the active ministry, again, looking at Rickert in one of his, to follow Rickert in one of his arguments, articles, it said, pointing to Canon, I think, 331, where it talks about that it's in virtue of the office that the Pope receives the power to do X, Y, and Z. So if you resign the doing of it, that entails resigning the office itself, too. I guess the analogy I would make would be like if someone told you, I'm not going to play second base on your baseball team anymore, you wouldn't say, well, are you still going to be the second baseman, though? I mean, if you stop doing, you stop being in that sense. So I think the Benny Papas argument fails.
Right. And I think Ed Fester also wrote something about how they're essentially used synonymously, those two terms.
And then you look at, too, I mean, and then others have commented. Ryan Grant had written a nice article for 1 Peter 5 on that a few years ago. Cardinal Burke said he's looked at it, and the words are used interchangeably in the Declaratio. So, I just don't see the argument as working.
Now, that being said, though, why is it that Benedict Ratzinger, he still wears the white papal robes. He still is called Your Holiness. He calls himself Pope Emeritus, which is a term that I don't think was ever used before. He still lives at the Vatican. So all those things do seem to be like visual or other symbols of he still thinks that he's on some level the Pope or something. What do you take for all that, all those actions?
We'll go back to each of those specific things in a second. I think you have to step back and look what was Benedict trying to do. I mean, he was doing something that really hadn't been done, at least since Celestine, and Celestine V, who resigned. He was like a hermit before and decided after 5 or 6 months, man, I don't really want to be Pope anymore. Yeah, so in a way, he's kind of like that. He's also different. I mean, he resigned because he said of his weakness and incapacity to fulfill the office. And I think what he wanted to do, especially after having seen the John Paul's legacy and his waning years as a Pope, where he's just debilitated for the last several years and probably people making decisions around him. So he thought he would resign and kind of make it an attractive option for a future Pope, kind of be a trailblazer in the way he couldn't do the job anymore. And he wanted to kind of give it some structure that wasn't there. So he gave it a title, Pope Emeritus, and kind of created the style of dress. And we'll go with those specifically in a minute. And so I think that's what he's trying to get at. And I think Gonswain in his speech talks about this being a courageous act that strengthened the papacy. And how does it strengthen it? Then the Benny Papist would look at that and say, aha, that means he's still Pope. No, I think what Gonswain meant was that by recognizing his own weakness and leaving, he allowed a stronger, younger, more, you know, energetic Pope to come in and kind of revitalize the office, you know, instead of having the church languish for a few years when you have a, you know, sickly or ill Pope. So I think that was Benedict's intent. Now, I'm not saying I agree with it. I think that's what he set out to do. Now, in terms, and then like I said, the visuals are certainly not good. But let's take them, you know, one at a time. Pope Emeritus, it is the first time that word or title was used. And Brandmuller kind of went after Benedict for that. And that kind of led to a series of letter exchanges between them. And in it, Benedict said, well, because in an interview, Premier said there'd never been this before. And then, but Benedict had said, well, the other resigned popes, what were they? Essentially, if not Pope Emeritus. So he's essentially saying they were, in fact, what I am now in name. So he's just saying that the word didn't exist or wasn't applied back then for that, but the reality was there, and Pope Emeritus is just giving it a name. And if you look at why he chose Emeritus, now, I mean, I know his thought process there, but if you look at canon law, canon 185 talks about, you know, if someone loses an office due to resignation, they can use his honorific title, Emeritus. And Benedict lost his office. Now, of course, again, be clear, that canon did not apply to the Pope, because it specifically talks about resignations that need not be accepted, which does not belong to the Pope. But at least the analogy was there for Benedict to look at, using emeritus, loss of office, use of emeritus. So I think that's where that came from. Wearing of the white, though, again, this is something that Benny Papus will look at and say, aha, he's still a Pope. He thinks he's still a Pope. He's wearing white. But what they don't look at is that he's changed some things, too. He doesn't wear the mazzetta. Now, that's a symbol of authority. He doesn't wear the red shoes. That was a symbol of authority. He no longer wears the fisherman's ring. I mean, Godswin talked about this speech. He saw him take it off. So those things go on. And, of course, Your Holiness, again, confusing, admittedly. But I mean, we refer to, you know, presidents, former presidents, as Mr. President. You know, people might know a friend who's serving in the military. You know, you still call him Colonel, though, or General. He hasn't been for quite a number of years, and so I think that's what's going on there. And again, I think in Benedict's mind, he was just trying to give some framework, make it a little more attractive. So a man considering resigning the papacy, if you didn't think, oh, some Pope's going to lock me away in some cold, you know, hermitage in the mountain somewhere in a cave, you know, when you can live in the Vatican and have some comfort and be able to entertain people. So I think it's understandable, but I think when you really look at it closely and think about it, I think folks will see that there's nothing really there.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, because I was a huge fan of Joseph Ratzinger's writings. When I studied in the 90s theology, that was my favorite theologian, and I've read just about everything he wrote, at least that had an English translation. I don't read German. And I followed him. When he was elected Pope in 2005, I literally jumped up and screamed. I mean, I was like a little schoolgirl. I was so excited because I loved him so much. But there is the truth is, and this I've kind of seen over the years, is he's brilliant, first of all. I mean, I don't think anybody denies that the man is a brilliant man. But he does have some kind of funny, like kind of loosey-goosey theology at times. And if you look back at all his writings, he's definitely got influenced by some of the more modern theology. And he had the reputation as being this super traditionalist. He never was. And so I think what you're saying is correct in his decisions to make these, wear the white, the Pope Emeritus, like that. It's his effort to try to understand, to live out something that is not unique, because there have been papal resignations before, but almost in practice unique, because we've never had a situation where Pope resigned and it's a worldwide office that everybody is looking at all times. Sure. And personally, I think, and also like, so for example, if he goes back to being cardinal, let's say if he did that, does that mean he can go in the conclave? And, you know, and does that mean, and that would be weird if a former pope was affecting the election of the next pope. Does he go, but if he's elected, if he was named cardinal, can he actually lose that? Does he go back to being a bishop? Because you can't lose being a bishop. That everybody agrees. Once you're a bishop, you're always a bishop. And it seems to me that the smart thing to do for Benedict would have been to go back to being called Ratzinger, go live in a hermitage somewhere in the cold mountains or whatever. It doesn't have to be like, you know, totally ascetic. He's an old guy and stuff. But I think that would have led to a lot less confusion, because it does lead to confusion. But I would say that like just use the Pope Emeritus title as an example. Ed Fester brought this up, and I think others brought it up. The whole point of the title Emeritus means you're not that anymore.
That's right.
I'm a professor emeritus, I'm not a practicing professor anymore. That's the whole point of the title emeritus, is that you're not that anymore. Like a bishop emeritus, he's no longer the bishop of that diocese. I mean, that's the whole point. He does no longer has that office as the bishop of that diocese. And so it seemed, I mean, Pope Emeritus title, actually, I think it's problematic, but at the same time, it does actually say, I'm not Pope anymore when you say I'm Pope Emeritus. I mean, that's right.
I agree. And that's, again, going back to the Canon 185, again, it doesn't apply to the Pope, but as an analogy, it talks about the loss of office due to resignation, and that's Benedict's case. And so right there, the definition of emeritus, you know, signifies I've lost this office. And as the example of the professor emeritus or someone who, you know, has given up the office, I think it's quite clear. So I don't see that when someone really takes the time to look at that and think about it. Hopefully they'll see that's done. It's not ultimately a problem, but visually and certainly to the ear, it is problematic. If you imagine as Francis resigning, I think if I were Pope, you're not staying on Vatican. I'm sending you to the peripheries, somewhere out to the Amazon jungle, you know, with no phone or anything. You know, we're not going to see or hear from him again. And I think that's for the best. You know, it doesn't help having Francis bring cardinals to see Benedict because it just leads to confusion. And some of the Benedict papers were saying, well, he's doing that because he's trying to give him his Benedict blessing on them. It is confusing.
Right. Now, there's another. So we've mostly been talking about people who say his resignation is invalid almost by accident. He was too, you know, he was being a little too cute with how he did things, talking about the contemplative act of life, the munus and ministerium, stuff like that. But there are some who say that he actually, this was intentional, that in a sense, he knew this was not really possible, or at least he knows he's Pope right now. And what is the basic, like, how is that different from what we've been talking about so far? And what's the basic argument? Like, what's the whole point of this? If why did Benedict do this on purpose to retain the papacy, but not retain it somehow?
It is, to me, this is the strangest of the two theories. I mean, the substantial error theory, they suggest that, you know, Benedict had these strange theories about the papacy, and they try to point to certain documents in his past or other documents. But if you look at those in turn very closely, they don't say what the Benedict papers say they do. And this other theory that you talked about is that they look at the resignation, and they would disagree with, like say, with an Anne Barnhart or those types to say that you have to use the word munus for it to be a valid resignation. They say, no, munus is not necessary. They would kind of read it the way I suggested, that just you're talking about the word papacy, but you would still need a word that is an appropriate synonym that still conveys the idea of munus or officium to be valid. So you could say something like, I resign the papacy, I resign the you know, being Roman pontiff or something like that, and that would be perfectly acceptable. Now, but he didn't do that, so they would say that he resigned the ministry, he resigned the functioning of the papacy. So it wasn't an error but there's, since there is no juridical situation for that in canon law to do that, it's really kind of a meaningless act when you think about it. He kind of resigned doing it de facto. There's no legal component to this. And so why would he do that? Well, one, it allows him to keep the munus, keep being Pope. And that's the point, I think they would say, is that he resigned the kind of the doing, remained being the Pope, because his plan was, is that he saw how bad the church was, that people were kind of bad modernists, the modernist cardinals and bishops are out to seize the papacy and the church, and therefore by kind of retaining this kind of faux resignation, he's able to kind of protect the papacy and, you know, kind of keep it from, you know, the enemy. I think that's kind of, I think, their idea in a nutshell. But the problem with that, of course, is that, okay, then essentially, though, Benedict's been lying to the world. I mean, he hasn't been a true pastor. You know, he's supposed to be the pastor of what, a billion souls. So if you accept the thesis that Benedict's a true pope, then that does mean that Francis is an anti-pope. And then you have to say, okay, well, this anti-pope's doing all these evil things and leading people astray. How could Benedict justify doing that? You know, that'd be kind of, you know, gravely sinful to do that, to let the Lord's sheep to be ravaged by the wolves in such a manner. So that's kind of, I think, the downfall of that theory. So I just don't see that theory as, workable in any way.
And what is there, like, the people who advocate for that, what do they think is Benedict's end game? Obviously, I think he's 93 or something like that. He's obviously going to die before too long, I would think, and before or after Francis. What happens then when he dies? What do they argue for an end game here?
I don't think they may. I don't want to be dismissive of it. Maybe they do. But there is a new book that just came out. Andrea Chanchi, who's an Italian journalist, just wrote a book called The Ratzinger Code, which is now the Ratzinger Code kind of goes hand in hand with this master plan theory. They call it Plan B, is kind of the coined term for that. This is Benedict's Plan B to kind of hold on to the papacy, keep it from the bad guys. And he has a code that he kind of communicates what's really going on to those who kind of know the code, how to interpret words that he does say in public or to explain them away. That's called the Ratzinger Code. Chanchi recently wrote a book called The Ratzinger Code. It just came out. It's in Italian. I'm trying to get a copy of it. But I'm sorry, what was your question? So, but I think I don't know.
Is there an end game?
There may be an end game in that. I don't think, I've looked through his writings and I may have missed it. I don't think there necessarily is an end game.
And how about for any, I mean, I know like Anne Barnhart, for example, she basically, okay, let me take the step back for a second. It seems to me that we talked about at the beginning that there was a problem, and that's Francis. And so here's a potential solution. But if nothing else, it seems like this solution is far, far worse than the actual problem we have. And I will give Anne Barnhart credit. She kind of admits this, that Benedict is a terrible person, for screwing all this up. But it does seem like if Benedict accidentally screwed up, he's one of the biggest idiots ever to hold the papal office. And he didn't, and so that's a problem. And if he did it on purpose, that seems to make him incredibly evil, because, like you just said, he's the actual pastor of a billion souls, yet he's letting some other guy run things, and people think he's the pope when he's really not the pope. I mean, that seems incredibly evil, but it doesn't seem to solve. It seems to create more problems than it solves, because now we don't have a situation where, yeah, okay, we can just somehow dismiss everything Francis has done somehow, but it's not so easy because we have bishops who are named, we have cardinals, we have all this stuff. How do you ever clean this up outside of a completely divine type of intervention, miraculous intervention, which that's not how God normally works. I mean, that's just not, if you look at the history of church, that's not what he does. How do you clean all this up? Doesn't it seem like this is a far worse problem than it's trying to solve?
Yeah, I mean, basically with the substantial error theory, I mean, it was set out as a theory to kind of how to have a solution for one heretical pope, but you've created another heretical pope. You've created basically a heretic in Benedict, who had all these, you know, papal errors. And my question would be, if he so misunderstood the papacy that he can't resign it, how could he have accepted it? How could he validly accepted it? But it's kind of funny. You point that out, is that, yeah, the Plan B theory folks would say that they would say, of course, he's not evil, but they kind of view him as like a strategic genius. In fact, it's some of the words he used. It's a strategic ruse, a strategic retreat that he engaged in. So your two choices, though, really, if you're a Betty Papist, because those are the two main theories, is either you believe Benedict is a strategic genius or he's a theological fool. That's kind of it. And the kind of amusing thing is that the two sides that over the last 2 months or so, 2-3 months, have started to go at each other. Hmm. Um, and uh, you know, it's kind of funny because some of the articles that the Plan B people would say are probably things I could write or I have written, or some of the articles, types of arguments I've made against, say, like the Anne Barnhart theory. And of course, Anne Barnhart and Mark Doherty and others on their side kind of look at the Plan B people and say, well, your stuff is absurd. They're each calling each other's stuff absurd. And you end up is that the reality is if you take kind of like those two halves of their arguments and put them together, you have an excellent argument against Benny Papism. But hopefully maybe some Benny Papists will actually read that. I have an article on my site talking about that very fact, is that they make some valid points against the other. And if you put that together, maybe one day some folks will realize that this thing ultimately is, you know, not a valid theory.
Right. And I'll make sure I link to your blog, by the way, on the show notes so everybody can find it easily. So I ask you what the end game is for somebody who thinks he's a strategic genius. What's the end game for any Benny Papist, even one who thinks he was a theological fool? Like, how would have they ever offered a suggestion of how we do eventually resolve this? Because like I said, Benedict eventually dies. Do they think Benedict's going to take over before before he dies over Francis? Francis dies. I mean, how do they see the eventual resolution? Is it just a divine intervention?
I don't want to misrepresent your views. I have not seen that type of detail in their writings. It might be there, but I think what in terms of end game, what is practically there is, I think back in November, I believe it was, of 2011, a group of Benny Papists published a declaration. In this declaration, they declare, and as a petition, right now it has about 3,500, maybe up to 4,000 signatories up to this point, I would think. But this declaration says, you know, we declare our faithfulness to Benedict XVI, the one true reigning pope. And then they go on to mention that if they kind of set conditions that if there is a future conclave, like if, you know, Francis were to die, or if Benedict were to die, you know, what condition they basically would accept or reject a conclave. So basically, they would not accept any conclave while Benedict is still alive. So that means they'll call Francis' successor in that instance an antipope. If they were both miraculously dying on the same day, you still have a problem with the conclave because they would not accept any of Francis's electors, cardinal electors that he's chosen. So then again, you would have an anti-pope. So, you know, so I don't know where they go from there in that. I think that movement is, I didn't see who the folks were who started that, but looking at some of the signatories, I think it probably is more the Plan B people who kind of were behind the push for that. Like, I see Estefania Acosta, who is on that side of things, and she's written a book on Benny Papism. She's like the first signee of that thing. So I think they're doing that. I haven't seen Barnhart or some of the other names in the U.S. on that list. So I don't know if they're supportive of that initiative or not. But I think that at least one segment of Benny Papism is basically going down that route, and that's going to be being sedi vacantis once Benedict and or both the popes die.
Yeah, because it sounds like they would need a conclave that only has the cardinals that are appointed by Benedict or JP2, and that conclave alone they would consider valid, which realistically we know that's probably not going to happen. And so therefore, like you said, eventually it's just sedi vacantism because there's no way to elect a new pope. And that takes me to something, an important point that I want to address, which is the people who hold Benny Papist. I'm not necessarily talking about the leaders. I'm talking about just the rank and file Catholics. Like, how it would, are they, Jeff? I mean, I'm going to ask you a question I know you can't really answer, but I want you to at least kind of talk about it, is, are they in schism? Are they jeopardizing their salvation? Like, how serious is it for your rank and file Catholic to kind of think, you know, I think Benedict's actually the Pope, not Francis. Why does this matter? In other words,
Well, I'm hesitant to do that because I'm not a pastor of souls. But I mean, I would certainly I would counsel anyone, you know, don't follow a theory until you have to, you know, until the contingencies of the moment kind of force you to make a choice. No one has to make any choices right now to be so committed to some of these theories. Kind of wait and see. I mean, there are no active ordinaries or cardinals who are supporting any variety of Betty Papism. So you're really out there on a limb following this. I can understand. I think, I mean, I can't, I don't know how the Lord looks at it all this time. You know, I would hope, you know, that, I mean, clearly there's reason to question what the heck's going on. And so in that sense, it's certainly natural. And I think you have to kind of try to rein yourself in, not to let yourself go too far. You got to wait for evidence. And, you know, when I first started looking at Benny Papism, I was kind of hoping it was true. Yeah, so on my blog, I've looked at, certainly back in the 2017 period, looked at some oddities about Francis or the conclave, and a lot of stuff in the conclave since then. But back in 2017, I'd written an article, did some research, actually suggested to me by a Jesuit or Jesuit sources that, you know, looking at the Jesuit vow thing, you know, obviously Francis was a Jesuit, and amongst their vows is a vow that they would not accept, you know, election or higher office, that type of thing. So I kind of looked into that. I did a lot of research, kind of an interesting subject. I mean, I didn't come to a conclusion that, yes, this is true, because it wasn't for me to do. And I think I think the important thing to keep in mind when we look at these theories is that we have to kind of think along with the church. The church has authority, the bishops and the cardinals, and obviously together with the Pope to come to judgments on these matters. And though, even though we might try to wonder what's going on with Francis, which is normal, have our own theological opinions about where he is on some of these things, ultimately it's going to have to be a future pope or council, pope and councils, to kind of look at the papacy the last 9 years or so, or however many more are yet to come, and come to a judgment on to what actually happened. And unfortunately, I think with at least what can happen with Benny Papism right now is that they're coming to a decision point. And that, again, like we talked about, that declaration, I mean, on both sides, of whether the folks have signed the declaration or not, there's lots on the substantial error side, like Anne Barnhart just saying Francis is definitely an anti-pope. So, I mean, the logic of that conclusion is not going to lead you to a place. I mean, you end up being in that camp of saying any future pope, you know, with Francis's electors or whatever, in certain circumstances, you're going to be a sede vacantis. They always say, well, we're not sede vacantis. Well, you will be. You're not yet. you can give it a few years. I mean, they say Francis might be gone in a year. I don't know if I buy that, but I saw an article, I think this morning or last night, that John Swain saying that Benedict's talking very low now. So who knows how much longer we have. So so back to your question, though, I think you can't be separated from the Roman pontiff. That's just, you know, Catholic theology is Catholic, is a canon, it's teaching. You got to just go with what, you know, appears to be the case. So Francis went through a conclave. There haven't been any formal objections ever made. He's been Pope for 9 years. So from all outward appearances, processes, and procedures, he's Pope. And that's just kind of common sense. And to kind of be looking through old Ratzinger things he wrote 50 years ago and saying, aha, you know, this and that thing and this, I think is not going to put you in a good place in a few years. I'd suggest to people, you know, prayer, prudence, and patience. You know, wait. We got to wait and see. It's not for us, ultimately, the laity, to decide this. And God, if the bishops and cardinals don't get it right next time, you know, I think God will certainly step in at some point.
Right. And I think, I mean, personally, I don't want to demean the sincerity or the intentions or anything like that of those who hold the Benny Papist arguments. I know online it can get a little bit rough because there are some Benny Papist advocates online who are just very uncharitable, very aggressive, and just not people you want to be around. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about just the regular person. And I personally do think it is very spiritually dangerous to go wholehearted, just to really accept the Benny Papist view, because I think it has a certain Gnostic quality to it, that we have this certain knowledge that's not available to most, and we had to dig through all this to find it, and then we got it. And so we have a kind of a knowledge that the average Catholic does not have, and that puts us kind of aside from them in a sense that we have the truth, and your normal Catholic does not have the truth. But the fact is, Catholicism is almost the diametrical opposite, that revelation is public, the church is visible, and that we can know certain things with a certainty because we trust the visible church. And the fact is that the visible church, meaning all the bishops, essentially all the bishops, all the active bishops, all the cardinals, they accept Francis as Pope. And if in a billion member Catholic church, I would say it's probably 99.99% that accept Francis Pope. Now, that doesn't mean we're a democracy. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying, though, is that this is how God lets us know what's going on, is that we have this visible church. We can all see. We can point to who the Holy Father is. We can say, that guy right there, he's the Pope. If we can't say that, we really get in a spiritually dangerous place, because we're veering away from some of the fundamentals of the incarnational nature of Catholicism. And I think ultimately another reason it's spiritually dangerous is because, like we've said, where does it go? It will lead to sedevacantism, and it will lead you eventually into schism with the actual Catholic Church. I mean, I think you can make an argument, maybe even somebody who really thinks Benedict is Pope, especially if a priest uses the name Benedict in the Mass, that itself is an act of schism, because that's how we know who you're in union with, is the Pope you mentioned and the bishop you mentioned. So I do think there's a lot of danger. And like you said, I think it's like, yes, we can acknowledge that there's lots of problems with Pope Francis. We can acknowledge that freely. And we can even say, maybe one day a future pope or a council or something will declare that Francis's papacy was, I don't know, invalid, null, something, whatever. You can even think that. But you don't want to put yourself in that position where you're making that judgment, because the whole point of being Catholic is that the Pope or the bishops or, you know, some actual authority makes that decision and declares it, so the whole world knows it. I don't have to figure it out. You don't have to figure it out. We just trust that that's how God is leading the church. Even through these very fallible, sinful men who are leading the church, we still can know certain things with moral certainty, at least for now.
That's right. And I think patience is key. And waiting, you know, just, you know, the church is 2,000 years old. You don't expect an instant answer tomorrow. I guess that's kind of the appeal to Benny Papism. Oh, I got my solution now. But you look at church history. I mean, you know your church history. Look at something like Pope Honorius. Right. I mean, he was ultimately essentially Leo II basically condemned him for being a favorer of heresy, I guess, is what the conclusion is of time. But, you know, there had been 40 years between the death of Honorius and until Leo II and the council of the sixth ecumenical council condemned Honorius. Look at John XXII. It took a few years even after his death before Boniface VIII, you know, kind of clarified matters on the beatific vision. So, you know, wait and see. You know, it will come around. You know, things are bad, but we've had bad times before. Maybe certainly not as bad as this time. I think I'll give Benny Papers that. I probably agree with maybe 99% of, maybe 100% of their diagnosis of the church right now. But I mean, I think the solution they've chosen is not going to lead to a good end, unfortunately.
Okay, I think we'll wrap it up there. So your book is coming out pretty soon.
August, yeah.
August, okay, great. And so we'll definitely look for that. And just for now, though, I encourage people to go to your blog. You write about this pretty frequently and keep up with the latest what's going on. So, and I'll link to that also in the show notes. And also, I think you're on Twitter, is that right?
I am.
Okay, so... I'll put the link to the Twitter as well, so people can follow you there if they want to. Okay. Well, I appreciate it again, Steve. Thanks for coming on the program. And everybody else, just God bless you and God love you.